Bookend your day with Essential Listening. Breakfast and Drive from 6am and PM on RN.
And hello there, Natasha Mitchell, joining you on RN now for Life Matters. Fantastic to have your company this morning on RN. I wonder if you saw the news reports yesterday on the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse. Those brave, brave women giving their accounts of the physical, sexual, psychological abuse that they experienced at the Parramatta Girls' Home. Really tough testimonies to give and to watch. All strength to them for managing to do that. And you might recall a few weeks back we looked at the role of GPs in detecting child abuse cases, because prevention is key, isn't it? Today, though, a doctor who wants GPs to be cognizant of the impacts of early abuse on the health of the adult patients they see. What can GPs do? What can they look for? And it's a very personal story for her, as we'll hear. Plus, a story of kindred spirits and the meeting of them. Love to hear from you today at RN Life Matters and our listener feedback line 02 833 1430. Well, on Friday this week, for our talkback, we want to ask you about that whole issue of reskilling, what it takes, what your experiences might have been. This, of course, is off the back of the flood of layoffs announced across the manufacturing sector. And, of course, this morning we await news from Qantas, probably right now, in fact, on their staffing plans. But what if you felt you might never find a job, no matter what's happening in the wider economy? Right from your teen years, the workforce just doesn't feel like an inviting place for someone like you, or with your particular skills. And by someone like you, I mean people who autism advocate Jeanette Purkis has well in her sights. Jeanette was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when she was 20. And as an Aspie, she knows just how hard it can be for young people on the autism spectrum to really launch themselves into the workforce. And she's written an inspired guide. It's called The Wonderful World of Work, a workbook for Aspertines, and she joins me now. Welcome, Jeanette.
Hi, Natasha.
Great to have you. I mean, this is a great book. And I mean, we have to remind people that some of the most super talented workers would self-identify as Aspies. You have the stereotype, of course, of, you know, half the Silicon Valley workforce.
Definitely, definitely. And I think people with Asperger's have a lot to bring to the workplace. We have skills that we're particularly good at. We're often very focused, very dedicated and loyal. So we do have a lot to bring.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to exploring some more of those skills. We are talking a spectrum here, though, aren't we, of behaviours and capacities. This is as much about different ways of processing information and approaching the world. We don't necessarily think of this as a disability.
No, I don't ever look at it as a disability. I see it more as a difference. And I feel that if everybody in the world had Asperger's, the world would still function. It would function in a different way, but it would function. And I think the disability element of Asperger's is often the reaction you get from the non-Asperger's world and how people don't accept you, and that results in anxiety and feelings of isolation and things like that. But I feel it's actually just a different way of processing information.
Do prospective employers always see it that way, though?
I'm not sure. I mean, obviously each employer is different, and a lot of people on the spectrum have difficulty gaining work because of employer attitudes, that they have someone at an interview who seems different and they think, oh, this person won't fit into our team. So my feeling about an interview is once you get to the interview stage, you've already proven you can do the job, and the interview is just the way of seeing if you'll fit into the workplace. And I think a lot of people on the autism spectrum can face difficulties in that interview stage.
Yeah, and you're really about skilling up young people to feel that they can equip themselves to perform in an interview. So this is very personal for you. I mean, you've got a job, I think you've been in it for about 7 or so years at the public service. You love it. It's a perfect fit. But you had some struggles yourself early on, didn't you?
Oh, definitely. I had a very, I always say I've had an interesting life. I wouldn't classify it as good or bad. Mm. When I was younger, when I was a teenager, I got a job. It's the first thing I did when I moved out of home. And it was during a recession. So I went to about 50 interviews and the first job I got, I took and stayed in for 2 years. But when I got older, I got involved with some negative people, some extremist political people, criminal people, that kind of thing, and ended up on a very negative trajectory with my life and in a position where I certainly thought I was incapable of finding work. And it took me about 7 years to get my act together, to get an education, to test the waters with employment to a point at which I was confident. And then after that 7 years, I thought, this is it. I need a full-time job. And I joined the public service and I really enjoy it.
So a whole suite of challenges there, not just having Asperger's syndrome.
Definitely.
So, I mean, knowing a whole stack of Aspie people myself and people who would identify as nerds through high school as well, let's face it, and I guess I was surprised to hear from your analysis of it is that a lot of young people with Asperger's actually don't see a future in the workplace for themselves. And even worse, they go straight on to disability support right at the beginning of when they might be launching themselves on the world.
Yes. I didn't have a diagnosis when I was a kid. The diagnosis was not available until 1994. So, you know, I was well and truly an adult by then. But that was a bad thing because I didn't address any of the issues I had. But it was a good thing because it led to me being independent. So it's really, you really have to be careful with the diagnosis that it doesn't become a self-fulfilling prophecy and it doesn't become something negative. And you do come across young people who, when they're 16, they go on the pension and that's all the future they see. And I think that's really a real tragedy.
Yeah. I mean, what is it about that? What is it about that self-fulfilling prophecy? What do they feel about themselves that doesn't fit with work?
I think it's often the case that they go through school and they've got learning support and all those things are a good thing, but they start to view themselves as being different from the rest of the world and having difficulties. You know, my life's difficult, so I can't do things that other people do. And I think that's a real problem. I think obviously learning support, teachers' aides, all those things are great. But I think they need to come with a caution. I think we need to be making sure that we build in that independence, that challenging yourself a little bit for the kids on the spectrum.
Jeanette Perkis is joining me first up on Life Matters today. She's written a terrific workbook for Aspie teens, teenagers with Asperger's syndrome. It's called The Wonderful World of Work, and it's about really inspiring young people who have been diagnosed with Asperger's with possibilities for work for themselves. Now, so where do you get young people to start with this workbook? Because it can be really bewildering knowing how to mesh your interests up with employment or with learning and educational opportunities.
Yeah. Well, the workbook goes through a number of life stages, and so it sort of is roughly chronological. So it starts out with why you want to get a job and then staying in school, getting an education, gaining skills, interviews, resumes, and then how to communicate in the workplace. But it's from a very positive viewpoint. And the whole way through, I'm saying you can do this. You know, if I did this, you can do this. And that's really the key message, is that kids on the spectrum can do anything that people who aren't on the spectrum can do. It shouldn't be a limit. And the book helps to empower people to understand how they can make their passionate interests into a work-related skill, what skills they might already have that they're not aware of, and just practical things like how do you write a resume, what do you put in it, how do you communicate with your boss, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that young people with Asperger's often have extremely passionate interests that they are very focused on.
Definitely. And often, I mean, if you look at universities, I suspect, particularly from my experience of study, a lot of the senior lecturers who are very expert in one specific rarefied little esoteric area, I think a lot of them anecdotally are on the spectrum. So if you've got if your kid's fascinated by insects, they could become an entomologist and they could become the key expert on dragonflies or something, and using that interest could translate directly into a skill.
But before we come to how they translate their passions into actual work opportunities, I wonder whether part of this is also that kids have had a pretty bad time at school sometimes. They might have been ostracised, they might have been bullied, and so they just, so that actually, that lack of confidence comes to frame how they feel about workplaces as well.
Absolutely. I remember my first job was in a fast food restaurant, so most of the staff were under 20, and there was a boy there, or young man there, who, if I'd been at school with him, he would have been a bully. I could tell that, and I was terrified of him, but he actually quite liked me. And that kind of thing, you know, those memories of school can really sap your confidence and can make it very difficult to have realistic colleague relationships at work.
And it means that kids can also drop out of school before they've actually given themselves a chance.
Absolutely.
So you suggest there's a great case study, and there's quite a few in the workbook, but one that stood out for me was that of 23-year-old Andy, who, you know, high-functioning autistic, loved drawing, enrolled in a visual art trade course, but work proved more elusive. So volunteering became a start for him.
Yeah, volunteering is a great place, not just for people on the spectrum, but volunteering is a great place when you're looking to find a job, if you've been out of the workforce for a while or if you've never been in the workforce. It proves to employers that you're so dedicated to finding a job that you will give your labour for no wage. It also makes you feel good. You know, if you volunteer at a gallery or at an aged care facility or at the vet hospital or wherever, it builds your confidence in your work skills and makes you feel good about yourself because you're doing a good thing. And I'm a big fan of the work experience volunteering thing for people who've been out of the labour force for a while.
So what did Andy do?
I can't remember that
No. But, well, I can remind you. He went and volunteered at an art gallery.
That's right, yes.
Which resulted in work for him. He ended up becoming an assistant, a gallery assistant.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, there are fantastic. There's also a great case study of a couple of teachers who are both on the spectrum as well. Mm. Now, the job interview. Okay, so we haven't got to the workplace yet, but the job interview. I mean, scary for most people, but for someone with Asperger's or autism, reading and missing, failing to read those non-verbal cues in an interview, how significant is that?
Oh, it's huge. And an interview can be really frightening. If you've got a panel, you go in there and there's three or four people firing questions at you. It can be really daunting. And if you don't know what to expect, if you're new to the world of work, it's a scary, scary thing. And I think entering it with a view that it's a conversation and you're actually meeting people like you'd meet people at your local autism organisation or at school or church or wherever is really important, rather than thinking, oh, this is this big scary thing, to actually approach it. I'm talking to these people about myself, about what I can do, about what I know. And often I think our concerns around, will they think I'm really weird, or will I get this wrong, will I get all the non-verbal cues wrong, I think we worry a bit too much about that. I think we can put too much emphasis on that. And I think just go for it. Just go into it with an attitude of confidence and think, well, I'm going to do the absolute best I can. I'm going to be myself because they want to hire me, and just come in from that position.
Yeah, you can get really tangled up when you're overly anxious, but you do bring up the eye contact issue in an interview because that's significant.
I think so. I think neurotypical non-autistic people have an expectation for eye contact, and I don't do it. I've got strategies. I look at the top of people's forehead, and so they might think I'm looking at their eyes, but I find eyes very threatening. I can't look people in the eyes. It scares me. Mm. But I know that the neurotypical people, the non-autistic people, that's one of the key ways in which they communicate. So I just look at a point a bit above their eyebrows, and that usually works.
Yes, the illusion of looking in people's eyes is the key perhaps here. Jeanette Perkis is with me this morning. She herself was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at age 20, but she's really wanting to encourage young people who also might identify as Aspie or have Asperger's or are on the autistic spectrum to be inspired about the possibilities of work, and she's written a book called The Wonderful World of Work. I know parents will be listening with acute interest to this too. I know when I posted on Facebook, Jeanette, this morning, people were liking the fact that you were coming on. So you get the job, and there are challenges here. for people in a workplace? Because reading emotional cues is a crucial part of getting on with your colleagues and collaborating with your colleagues. So what are some of the ways that you guide young people through that whole minefield?
Well, I give them some practical advice. So for example, there's a whole chapter on what do you do on your first day, because your first day is very scary. You're meeting all your colleagues and managers for the first time. You're going to a new workplace. You're doing a new job. It's a very challenging and frightening time for a lot of people, not just people on the autism spectrum, I would suspect. And so I give, you know, when you get there, who do you talk to? What do you do on your first day? How do you get across that you're keen and enthusiastic? And communication is often around some practical things as well. So I give advice on how do you do after work drinks? You know, if the workplace go out for a Christmas party or on a Friday night, what do you do? And if you don't want to go, how do you make an excuse that's polite and acceptable? And how do you talk to your colleagues, and how do you talk to your manager, and how do different managers have different styles, and how do you respond to the different management styles, and just a whole load of quite complex information just sort of stepped out in a practical
hugely
way.
Hugely important, because being adaptable is part of the challenge, isn't it? And also navigating change, that can be very anxiety-inducing for someone with Asperger's.
Oh, absolutely. Change is probably one of the most frightening things we have to deal with as people on the spectrum. And there are, you need to find some strategies for dealing with change, because change is the only constant in life. You know, everything you do is going to be different 6 months, a year, 2 years down the track.
Big part of the modern workplace as well.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, isn't it? So,
yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
How do you get people? Because that's resisting their very being.
Yeah, I've got a few strategies for change. One of them is the pros and cons. If you've got a change coming up, get together with someone who might be involved in it, or might be a friend or a family member or something, and write down the change and what it means, and write down the good things about it and the bad things about it, and see if it's a good change or a bad change. Because if it's a good change, you can sort of adjust your attitude to think this is actually a positive thing. And if it's a bad change, you can work out some strategies with how do I make this work, you know, how do I make this livable.
So just finally, what do you think about employment agencies that specialise in helping people with autism or on the spectrum find work? Whether or not some jobs are more Aspie friendly than others, and whether an employment agency like that can actually guide people.
I got my public service job through an autism specific employment agency. They were very good. I think a lot of the organisations are great. I think there is a lot to be said for going to an autism-specific organisation if there's one in your area, because they know more about the landscape of employment, and they know more about how to deliver services to clients who have an autism spectrum condition. I found it very helpful, and I think there are jobs which are more Aspie-friendly than others, or Auti-friendly than others. You find that men on the spectrum tend to gravitate towards, not always, but that there's a tendency for working in IT or engineering or mathematics or something like that. Mm. And with the women on the spectrum, there's more of a tendency for them to work in caring professions like nursing or psychology. So there are areas of work where there are a lot more Aspies than others, and I think some jobs are easier for us to do than others are.
Lots to think about. Thank you so much for joining us, and I know plenty of Aspie women in the engineering professions too. So it works both ways. Look, terrific guide, very practical. Jeanette Perkis, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Great, thanks for having me.
Jeanette's book is The Wonderful World of Work, a workbook for Asper teens. It's published in April in Australia, so look out for that by Jessica Kingsley Publishers. We'll pop the details on the Life Matters website. And if you want to find out more about Jeanette's own story, her book about all that is called Finding a Different Kind of Normal. We'll pop the details on the Life Matters Facebook page about that one. Love to hear from you. Perhaps you're a parent. Perhaps you're a self-identified Aspie. How have you gone at work? What's worked for you? What really hasn't worked for you? You can get in touch on our website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Life Matters. And our listener feedback line, 02-833-1430. We're going to look at the whole issue of whether GPs can help adults who have, survived sexual abuse early in their childhood.
I listen to jazz like Coltrane, and I listen to a pied butcher bird, and I hear the same methodology. They have this little theme that they set up, and then they can wander off on all sorts of magical improvisations, and they can put references to other artists in there. Endless variation with the butcher bird. There's one.
Recording birds in the wild. It's a kind of benign hunting. That's 360 Documentaries, Sunday morning at 10.
Oh, we'll be so tuning into that one. I love birds. Keep an eye on them in my urban environment all the time. Now, look, a few weeks ago on the show, we spoke to paediatrician and child abuse researcher Kim Oates about the role medical practitioners can play in identifying and also in reporting cases of child abuse. It's a really delicate terrain, as you know. But as the public hearings of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse are revealing all too clearly, many, many cases of childhood abuse go unreported, unrecognised and undiscussed, which means the burden of that abuse is carried into adult lives. And evidence suggests now that that can dramatically affect a person's physical health, their mental health, and this is where doctors can play a role. Dr. Kathy Kesselman is the president of Adult Surviving Child Abuse. It's a peak national body providing support services to people affected by childhood abuse and trauma, and she joins us this morning on Life Matters. Welcome, Kathy.
Thanks so much.
I mean, every experience is different. Every adult is different. Are there some common enduring effects of child abuse that you see in adults?
Look, because when children are abused, it happens during a very crucial developmental period. It can potentially affect every aspect of a child's functioning. It affects the development of the brain. And people present to their doctors with diverse presentations, often with many diagnoses, and often they're labelled and people respond to symptoms without thinking about the underlying cause. But, you know, when we're talking about common presentations, depression, anxiety, and the adoption of coping strategies such as smoking and alcohol abuse, physical inactivity. And when we say coping strategies, these are ways that people who've been abused can try and calm down their emotions and regulate their mood. Mm. But what happens is that they become risk factors for later adult disease.
Part of the problem here is that consultation with a GP, Kathy, is so, so brief. You can barely have enough time to skim the surface of you in the present, let alone you in the past.
Yes, look, I mean, having been a GP myself for 20 years, I know how demanding that is. But, you know, there's been a study in the States which looked at online screening for GPs, which patients filled in at home and then brought into their primary care practitioner. And what that showed is that when people are asked the question about trauma, and that when GPs respond in a validating, empathic and understanding way, that there's a profound benefit to that individual. And certainly that's what we're seeing with the Royal Commission, people being heard, being listened to, the commissioners bearing witness. And that study actually showed a 35% reduction in visits to GPs the following year after that was introduced.
Was that the main measure of benefit?
11% reduction to emergency services, 3% reduction in hospitalisations. So profound impacts, and that's just being listened to. That's not about referring people to ongoing therapeutic support, which of course also obviously has profound benefit, as long as that support is provided by people who have the experience and the expertise to support people who've experienced this particular form of trauma, complex trauma.
We have a much clearer picture, don't we, of the health impacts now of early childhood abuse in adults. There's been some very powerful work coming out of the US, the ACE study, for example, which stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. They're tracking, I gather, a cohort of patients and performing routine health checks, and they have a deeper understanding of their trauma histories as well.
Yes, look, I mean, the ACE study looked at 10 different adverse childhood experiences, so all forms of abuse and neglect, the effects of growing up with domestic violence, a parent with a mental illness, a parent who abuses substances, and also when people don't grow up with their two biological parents. And these formed 10 ACE measures. And what was found was that there was a cumulative score given, one for each of these particular adverse experiences. And when one rates the different categories and looks at different scores, there's a linear relationship between increasing ACE scores and increasing impacts in adulthood, from obesity to depression to suicide attempts to drug abuse to alcoholism, and all those risk factors that we just spoke about, which cause also physical health issues. So also a very direct linear relationship to liver disease, heart disease, chronic lung disease, diabetes. So all of the very key public health issues that we're dealing with, and yet often the underlying trauma is not screened for, it's not acknowledged, it's not identified, and of course when it's not on a doctor's radar, you know, it can't be identified and addressed.
Is empathy the only role you see for GPs? What else can GPs do to link the health of the patient sitting before them with their story of abuse in a way that is meaningful and positive for the patient?
Yes, well, obviously, you know, having it on their radar in the first instance, listening, validating, and providing that empathic support, along with the professional and medical expertise that GPs can bring to the table.
Many GPs would be frightened to go there, though. They want to contain that interaction to something that's perhaps more manageable for them.
Yes, look, but what this does is create the environment in which disclosure can occur, the discussion can begin, but of course then there needs to be referral pathways to people who can continue providing the care and support. And certainly our organisation, ASCA, runs a 1300 line, 1300 657 380, on which we have trained therapists. And
I'll put that information on our website.
And it's backed by a referral database of health practitioners around the country and agencies that have experience in working therapeutically with survivors so that they can find pathways to recovery. Because what we know nowadays from the science is that recovery is eminently possible. And so it's very sad to see that often those pathways aren't initiated and people can't access and afford the right care. And sadly, you know, from that 1300 line, we also hear the impacts of when practitioners haven't been educated and haven't been informed, when survivors have their experiences minimised and dismissed, when they're told it's such a long time ago, it can't be affecting you now. A lot of that is around the shame of this issue. Survivors bring their own inappropriate shame, of course, and when both the community and practitioners are not informed about what it means to have been abused, and aren't comfortable themselves to begin to support people and hear their stories and validate them, then of course we get a very negative response.
I want to come to what recovery can look like, but this, if you don't mind me asking, this is not just a professional interest to you and an advocacy interest as a doctor, but also it stems from personal experience. This is what's really connected you with this whole issue of advocacy and the role that medicos can play.
Yes, look, you know, and I was sexually and emotionally abused as a child, did work as a GP, which may surprise people that I was able to finish my education, was able to be a GP, but my abuse did impact me profoundly. It certainly meant that I was very emotionally detached. I was really quite robotic in my engagement, and what's happened to me as a result of my process of therapy is that I've changed enormously, and obviously I've also developed a personal passion here. But when I first started dealing with my trauma, I developed a very profound anxiety. I had panic attacks. I became very depressed, suicidal, and started to experience flashbacks, which were very easily triggered, which threw me back into being a child in abject terror and horror and re-experiencing what had happened to me as a child. And of course that's incredibly frightening. It was frightening for me and obviously frightening for my family. But finding a therapist for me who was able to sit with me, think with me, bear witness to whatever I brought into that room, allowed me to process that and make meaning of it and find a path towards recovery. And there is hope and optimism. People can resolve their trauma. And certainly for me, having gone through that process, it's made me much more empathic and emotionally available to my own children, my own family. And, you know, one would rather, of course, never have been abused in the first place. But certainly having had that experience.
Sometimes wisdom comes from trauma. I wonder, Kathy Kesselman, how your doctor... Doctors are notoriously bad at seeking help from their doctors. We know this. But how, did you seek the help of a GP initially?
No, look, I certainly didn't. And sadly, when I had to give up work because I had a breakdown, my medical colleagues were probably some of the least empathic. And I think that's because, you know, not because they're bad human beings, but because they were scared and frightened, because they were seeing one of their group falling off the twig, so to speak. And they didn't know what to do, and that's where we get back to the need for education and understanding and empathy. If we're going to really see survivors embraced within communities, their own communities, and within the health and welfare communities as well.
Well, perhaps the place to start is what doctors are most comfortable with, and that is seeing this as a health issue, which the evidence, as you've conveyed, clearly says it is.
Yes, and starting to identify, you know, some of those presentations which they can't quite put their finger on, you know, chronic pain syndromes which can't be labelled, which don't fit into the box, mental health issues, the depression which isn't getting better with medication but which is underpinned by trauma which needs to be resolved prior to the depression lifting, and that's precisely what happened to me. I was acutely suicidal, and it was only through my process of therapy and working through what happened to me that my depression lifted, and of course my suicidal ideation also resolved.
Just finally though, this is delicate terrain, and you know this better than most. It's delicate for doctors, and we brought up some of those sensitivities in terms of them identifying sexual abuse or child abuse in the case of families and children. But this is quite a difficult conversation for a GP to initiate, because you don't want to be suggesting abuse when it might not have happened, given all we know about the debate and difficulties around false memories.
No, absolutely, and you don't want to be also prodding people where they don't want to go, and that's why we, you know, certainly as ASCA is advocating trauma screening along the lines of what happened in the States, so people can fill a trauma screen in as part of a medical questionnaire at home, bring it into their doctor and then have it discussed. But certainly what was found in the States was that people responded very positively to having the issue revealed. So when they'd responded in the affirmative to any particular trauma question, the practitioner would then say, look, I see that you've responded to X, Y and Z. Mm. How has that affected you? How can I help?
Mm. Yes, great advice. Really great to have you on the program. And after viewing those testimonies by the women in the Royal Commission yesterday, those women who had survived their experiences at the Parramatta Girls' Home, this is a really important conversation to be having with you.
Thank you. Of course, those testimonies are chilling beyond belief. And I think what we're seeing as a community is that, sadly, they're absolutely horrific, but the number of people who are coming forward and the fact that it's still, you know, ongoing, because some of the public hearings are related to abuse that's occurring today and the lack of systems response.
That's right. This is not just in the past. And I note that that's going to be an issue later in the week at the Commission. Let me just give out that number again as I say farewell. It is Adults Surviving Child Abuse, a peak national body providing support services to people affected by childhood abuse and trauma. And the number is 1300 657 380. That's 1300 657 380. And that's 9 to 5 Monday to Sunday, I gather. Is that right, Cathy?
Right. Thanks so much.
And I'll just give out Lifeline as well, 1300 11 14, 24 hours, 13, 11, 14. Dr. Kathy Kesselman, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And Kathy is president of Adults Surviving Child Abuse. We'll pop those numbers on the Life Matters website for you as well, in case you didn't have a pen handy. Well, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning on Life Matters, right here on RN, and a great story of meeting and mates coming up.
Meet the ABC Radio app. It gives you access to RN on your phone, along with 19 other ABC radio networks, including local radio, news radio, Classic FM, Triple J, and all our digital-only stations. The ABC Radio app also has program schedules, links to our current ABC emergency coverage. It's free. Download it by searching ABC Radio app and take ABC Radio with you on your phone.
Oh, I want to tell you about a special treat for RN listeners. Last year on Life Matters, we met pioneering film director Hafa Al-Mansour, and we replayed that interview over summer, so you might have caught it. Now, she directed the first feature film shot entirely in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the first Saudi film directed by a woman too. It's called Wadja. Her lead is this fantastic, feisty little character. Wadja is a 10-year-old girl who desperately wants a bicycle at a time where girls are banned from riding bikes in public in her country, girls and women. In fact, that has changed since the film was released last year. The Guardian included it in their top 10 films of 2013. RN has been given the opportunity to host screenings of Wadja right across Australia, and I'll tell you how you can find out about that in just a moment. Here's, though, part of my conversation with director Hafa Al-Mansour.
I wanted to make a film that has a lot of fun. It's humor. It is the situation in Saudi is very heavy when it comes to women. But for me, it is not. I don't want to make films about passive people or victims. I wanted to make films about victorious people who are changing the situation and moving ahead. And I think Saudi Arabia at this point is changing, is opening up. And people are becoming more tolerant and more accepting. And as you said, now we can ride bicycles. So changes are being introduced slowly and gradually, but changing the mind shift. I really don't want to make an angry film about, like, the situation in Saudi. It's more of about a story coming up from there and about people surviving the system, surviving how hard it is. And I wanted people to enjoy it. I wanted to make a film. For me, I grew up watching Snow White and stuff like that when I was really little, through video, of course. So, and I know the power of entertainment in film. It took me places where I never thought, in this small town, and I went to exactly the same, I went to public school exactly like Wajda's school, and the film in that way gave me so much, and I wanted in my film also to have this, the enjoyment, it's the humor, the feelings. It is not only like making a film about women in Saudi Arabia, it's more of taking people into a journey, yes, in Saudi Arabia, but still, like, I want them to enjoy that film.
Yes, but it's definitely got a rebellious message. I mean, it's let's not understate that. I mean, this is a little girl who wants to ride a bike illegally, and she's determined to do it.
No, she's very spiky. She finds her own way. And she maneuvers the system in a way that, like women, we learn that in Saudi. We have to maneuver the system that way to survive.
Yes, and there's all those, there's references to, you know, women being invaded in their homes by a thief, which is kind of a euphemism for acknowledging that she's having a relationship with a man outside of marriage.
It happens, like, you cannot, like, no matter how much you segregate people, people find each other.
That's right, they do, love will conquer.
Yeah.
Hafa, what was it like for you making a film? All filmed. The whole film was shot in Saudi Arabia. What was actually like for you? Did people actually let you do that?
Oh yeah, I did the film with permission from the Ministry of Culture and all that. And I wrote a film that's respectful. I know it is conservative. I wanted to maintain my voice as a filmmaker and make a film about women's rights and empowering and all that. But I respected. I knew my space where I moved in. So I got permission to shoot in Saudi, but shooting in Saudi is difficult because it's very conservative and it is a segregated country. So I wasn't expected to be in the streets, for example, giving direction to the DOP and being with an all-male crew. So I had to be in a van and I gave all my directions through a monitor and a walkie-talkie, and I would tell Wad, hey, Wad, you have to smile now. No, concentrate. All through the phone, and it was like, yeah. Well, difficult, but
it's amazing that you managed to do it. Well done, you. I'm really curious about the sort of risks that your main character in real life takes in performing in a film like this.
No, she got Best Actress in Dubai Film Festival, and she's enjoying all the attention and glamour. She appears on TV, and she asked me to give a quote or something sometimes. So I think she's celebrated. She's enjoying Saudi. It's not like before. Like, No, especially when she's young. She's not a woman yet, so she has all this privilege of being a child still, enjoying all those freedoms, but still even Sally has changed, so she feels accomplished, and she has now very high self-esteem because she was able to get her family to Venice, and it's really an accomplishment for her. I feel like it gives her a lot of confidence.
Film director there, Haifa Al-Mansour, director of Saudi Arabia's first feature film, filmed within the country, the first film of a feature length, and also the first film made by a Saudi Arabian woman too. And what's nice is that I recall that she did her film studies here in Australia, in Sydney. So it's a nice link that RN is now giving special screenings across the nation of her film, Wadja. Screening in all state capitals on Wednesday the 19th of March. Just head to the RN homepage, abc.net.au/RN. Look for Wadja under competitions. Wadja, W-A-D-J-D-A, in case. But it'll be pretty obvious, I reckon. So enjoy that on our behalf. On Life Matters here on RN. Up next, a special story from ABC Open. Now to how we met. That was the theme of a recent call-out as part of ABC Open's ongoing 500 Words project. It's a really terrific project. A new non-fiction writing challenge for you and a new theme each month. And they wanted stories from across regional Australia for this one of kindred spirits, how they met, what their relationship means to each other. And in her story, Me, Wendy and a Motor Scooter, Bunty Ellis Freeman takes us back to her bohemian youth in the back streets of 1950s Sydney, populated with great characters like the Ghost, the Mist, and her best friend Wendy.
We're on my motor scooter, heading for Clifton Gardens Pub. My scooter is a maroon-coloured Daimler Puch with a windshield. We call it Emma. We've only fallen off it once. Wendy has her hair in rollers, covered by a scarf, because we'll be going to a turn tonight. I let my long hair fly out, as they do in Rome. But we have to go to Cliffo to find out where the parties are, and then gate crash. We've had some luck in the past. One party was at St Ives, very posh house with a swimming pool. But crap people, so pretentious. We like to think we're intellectuals and carry philosophy books in our pockets. We usually hang out with the local boys at the point. John, Neville, Bobby, Dougie and Bert. He has a girlfriend, Patty, and I think they do it. Tony used to be a part of our crowd, but he absconded to the Conservatorium of Music. Fancied himself as a Benny Goodman. He has a girlfriend too. They definitely do it. But we have romantic aspirations for the North Sydney crowd. Max, Alan, the Ghost, the Mist, who are much more sophisticated and actually play jazz. They are usually at Cliffo on a Saturday arvo. Wendy and I met when we were 13. I lived in a flat next door to Tony. And of course his mates were always there, especially when my older sisters and I moved in with Mum. I'd never met anyone quite like Wendy. Outspoken, brave, and funny as hell. We hit it off straight away. Yet she is a real lady at times, paying careful attention to her clothes and hair, while I'm desperately trying to look bohemian. But she usually joins me in looking daggy, especially when her mum is not around. black as the go, stovepipe trousers, black jumper, and duffel coat in winter. Her mum is beautiful, with pale auburn hair and clear blue eyes, always immaculately dressed and urging Wendy to do the same. "Clean your teeth, Wendy," is a usual response to Wendy's careless appearance. Mrs. Mack has a great influence on me, taught me how to sew and knit, and never criticises my strange taste in clothes. Her dad is a sweet, quiet man who seems overwhelmed by the femininity of his environment. We often pinch his very large sweatshirts. He never complains. Wendy is like part of my family too. Mum works night shift at a posh Sydney hotel. My mum's Italian lover does odd shifts at the same hotel. Wendy successfully dodges his wandering hands and tells him off. "Lecherous old bugger, piss off!" Something I'd never be game enough to say. My older sister Jill, stunning looking and always in love or heartbroken, just tolerates us. Barbara, who's being courted by Bob, we don't like him, has fun with us while Mum works nights. We reenact slaughter on 10th Avenue. Barbara is the adagio dancer. Wendy and I take turns to be the barroom floozy, dragged across the floor and thrown onto a table. We've arrived at Cliffo, but bloody hell, I can hardly climb off the scooter. Something wrong with my knees. There are two long scars down them. Wendy is also having trouble dismounting. She seems much heavier. Her hair is no longer in rollers. It's very short and grey. Now I remember, we are both in our 70s. We've travelled these 60 years so closely together, we've hardly noticed the passage of time. I'm sure, if there's an afterlife, that we two will ride together again.
Fantastic. Bunty Alice Freeman with that story, produced by Sean O'Brien for ABC Open. And we're told that Bunty is a prolific contributor to the 500 Words project that ABC Open runs, regaling readers with all sorts of stories from her colourful life, from her time as a prison guard to the politics of small town Australia. Plenty of that going on, no doubt. More details on the Life Matters website, or you can head straight to ABC Open. A fantastic suite of projects from people contributing right across regional Australia, open.abc.net.au. Going to squeeze in some of your feedback from the week. Up next.
Gold and the Incas. It's a striking showcase of the ancient cultures of Peru, now showing at the National Gallery of Australia. RN, in partnership with the gallery, is offering listeners, one from each state and territory, an exclusive experience at the exhibition. Flights, accommodation and a VIP event included. Simply tell us what you'd create to represent the lost world of 20th century Australia. For details, look for Inca Gold on the RN homepage.
And a listener's just tweeted, it's been a week of fascinating interviews about meaty issues on Life Matters. We like it that way. And so to some of your responses to the discussion about potential changes to Medicare and the possibility of a co-payment yesterday, here are some of your calls in response. And has there been a response or what?
Listening this morning to Natasha talking about the $6 that the government's going to put on people going to the doctors because they reckon that, you know, it's costing too much for medical, whatever it is in Australia. But nobody ever seems to mention the remuneration that so many of these specialists get. It just seems to me that it's always the bottom of the line, the user that is the one that's cast as being the bad boy, and those that charge the extreme amounts of money for their services seem to be untouchable. Maybe the government should take a bit more of a look at the high payments to medical profession. Thank you. My name is Dave.
Hello, I'd just like to comment on the electronic health record. I'd be involved with that, except there's a little proviso there that all your data can be passed on to other government agencies. I don't want to give the government one damn thing. I don't have to give them because they use it against us. So if they can fix that, maybe I'd be involved. Thank you.
According to an article in the paper yesterday, it would appear that bulk billing only came about through these large, what they call supermarket agencies of doctors. It wasn't always the case, and in actual fact, Medicare allowed for you to pay a little. That, I think, should be cleared up. Thank you.
And thank you for your calls. Our listener feedback line 028333. Get in touch on anything that you hear. A few letters and Facebook comments on the Medicare discussion. Kathy writes, introducing a co-payment worries me a lot. Living in a rural location, I have very limited options for medical opinion and service. If I consult a GP, I'm at least $25 out of pocket. Out of hours, $100. Even for children, even in a life-threatening emergency. My experience is that co-payments definitely are a disincentive to obtaining medical opinion, which sometimes leads to poorer outcomes. I do think co-payments would lead to poorer chronic disease outcomes in the community and cost us all more. We're very lucky that we can afford our health costs, which have been considerable, but surely in our community, access to basic health and education should not be based on your individual or family funds if we want a better, fairer society. And Claire writes, I object to the imposition of yet another cost when the whole system needs an honest, not political, review. Our GP charges $75. We receive $30 plus from Medicare. Isn't that a co-payment? We have private health insurance, which is expensive, but when needed, we are always out of pocket, sometimes by thousands of dollars. Ageing is scary because of the fear of not being able to pay for the care of one's needs. I would prefer to see the Medicare levy increased and the number of private funds rationalised. Sherida writes, means testing. Too many very well-off people are draining the system. Clever accounting and asset distribution is robbing from the needy. And Karen writes, I would suggest to scrap the 30% taxpayer-funded subsidy to private health and put the money into the public system. That would be a step in the right direction. Otherwise, we will be headed closer to the USA with huge healthcare costs and very poor health outcomes. And Penny writes, for some people on very low incomes, a co-payment, even as low as $6, would be a barrier to accessing GP care. Many of the people who overuse GPs are elderly and live alone. They do so because they're lonely and frightened and need reassurance. We should find other ways of meeting these largely psychosocial needs, such as regular home visits by non-medical health care workers or personal support people. So lots there. And I just also want to let you know that Donna McDonald, the interview we did with Dr. Donna McDonald about her memoir, The Art of Deafness, I think it was, The Art of Being Deaf, and her life story and her relationship to her experience of deafness, which has presented its challenges but also opportunities. Well, that's now a transcript on the webpage. We don't ordinarily provide transcripts, but obviously we'd like that interview to reach wide and far across the deaf community. So if you have friends in the deaf community, please let them know that that transcript is up. I think that's probably all we've got time for now, but we will come to more of your letters hopefully next week, of course, and your feedback line calls as well. But Michael Cathcart is waiting at the other end of the line to tell us what's coming up. Is this musical theatre?
Yes, Bossa Nova today. We've got James Lee and Michael Munson, who are our men in the library. They're going to come out of the library with some of the LPs that are stored there in the archive. Dum, 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 dum. And they're
about friend who's a fantastic bossa nova singer and also a science journalist. So she's wears both hats. I mean, are you any good at dancing to bossa nova?
I'm not that clear what the bossa nova dance is, really.
Well, I mean, it's all sorts of stuff. It's samba. It's, you know, that whole, Latin American dancing.
I'll learn all about it.
Anyway,
we're going to do that. And we're going to talk to Robert Lepage, who's a fantastic Canadian theatre maker. He's one of the big names in world theatre, does spectacular works that end up in festivals and so on. And at the Adelaide Festival, people who are there are lucky enough to have the opportunity to see his show, Needles and Opium. And we're going to have a chat to him.
Oh, lots coming our way after the news. Thanks, Michael.
No worries.
Look, our Friday talkback is terribly very topical. It's about insecure work and reskilling. Have you managed to reskill? What are the challenges involved? Get in touch with us then. 10 a.m. on RN.
In the body sphere, living with a serious long-term illness, you or the person you love the most.
It's taken away from me the innocence that healthy people have.
What I didn't realise was that just watching the deterioration of someone, and for our eldest child in particular, I think this had a terrible impact.
An illness in the family, the body sphere, online at the RN website.